Stonewall Inn is home to one of the most important moments in American LGBT history. The 1969 riots from there are the subject of a play that opens tonight at the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. It's called Hit the Wall.
Part of the reason the LGBTQ movement was formed was because they were rejected from other movements. This riot, Stonewall, brought together a lot of different groups of people that became fragmented throughout the movement, but this one event included a lot of different groups of people.
Plus, is your pet stuck at home in this bitter cold? Well, just like humans, animals are vulnerable to weight gain and obesity. What can you do to keep your pets healthy, and what can we learn about our own health from our animals? But first, the label Asian American has only been around since the late 60s, when it started being used by civil rights activists. Today, where do Asian Americans stand in our country's ideas about race and identity? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Again, we hope everyone's staying safe and warm. And it is actually warming up. If yesterday wasn't crazy enough, this Sunday we're looking at weather in the 50s. All of you listening in Springfield, did you know that the projected high is 58 in Springfield on Sunday? So think about that. Coming up this hour, one of the most important chapters in LGBT history, told through a play that's opening tonight at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. And if you're stuck inside today with your pets, maybe not getting enough exercise, we're going to talk about what we're learning about animal obesity and how it relates to human obesity. But first, late last week, the director of a grad studies program at Duke University emailed her master's students with a warning. She said two faculty colleagues complained to her about Chinese students speaking in their native language, quote, very loudly in the student lounge and study areas. She went on to say that while she respected how hard it was to go to school in a new country, she encouraged Chinese students to commit to speaking English 100% of the time. Well, that email went viral, both among Asian and Asian American students. In China, the topic was viewed more than 130 million times on the social media platform Weibo. That professor has since resigned from her director position. At the University of Illinois here in Urbana, almost one out of every five students on the Urbana campus are of Asian descent. So what does this story and other news around issues like affirmative action show about where Asians fit in America? Oyen Poon has spent a lot of time thinking and working on some of these questions. She's an assistant professor at Colorado State University and the director of its RISE Center. She's here in Urbana today also to give a talk at the University of Illinois. She'll be at the Illini Union at noon, but she's with us live in studio now. I should say welcome back to Illinois, former UIC faculty member as well.
Loyola.
Welcome back to the 21st, and it's nice to have you here in person too.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We were going to get to the topic of your talk in a minute, but I wonder how you've been seeing this story unfold in the past week and a half around Duke University and this conversation they've been having.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say I was surprised to see that something like that would happen, but quite frankly, as we said right before we started talking, having worked in higher ed for almost 20 years now, it's not surprising at all, unfortunately. It also highlights, I think, an anti-Asian racism that continues to exist today. And I think, though, it really highlights the necessity of things like affirmative action to continue and to check things like this and to check for whether or not universities are valuing individuals as whole human beings, bringing various diversity to campuses and whatnot.
Mm. And you were tweeting about this earlier. You noted how many Black and Latino Twitter users were also showing outrage about this story. And then you said you hoped Asian American Twitter showed up for other people of color as well. Why is that important to you?
It really demonstrated to me, I think, the importance of solidarity, cross-racial solidarity, and I've seen it before, but I think with this instance, I think growing up, I was born and raised in Massachusetts and working as an Asian American academic, sometimes I've noticed anti-Asian incidents just kind of go under by the wayside and not a whole lot of outrage occurring. But in this instance, I started noticing how many actually on my feed, granted it's a limited feed, But I started noticing how many people were talking about this incident. And in fact, I noticed that it was actually more African Americans and Latinos on my feed that were talking about it and sharing experiences that they had that were quite similar. And so it was sort of like at the SAG Awards this weekend, where Sandra Oh basically cited Alfre Woodard as saying, you know, we're in the same fight. And it just really was heartening and encouraging to see that, yeah, we really do have to work cross race around a shared common problem.
And I want to ask you, bring that back to this issue about mm-hmm. affirmative action, because I think a lot of people might be thinking about the recent lawsuit, the ongoing lawsuit against Harvard University right now. I wonder first, before, can you just remind our listeners about this case for people who aren't familiar?
Sure. So Ed Blum and Abigail Fisher, you may have heard of them before because they had sued University of Texas at Austin in Fisher versus UT Austin. They formed an organization called Students for Fair Admissions, SFFA, and they're suing Harvard, UNC Chapel Hill, and I believe they're suing UT Austin again. So they are white identified individuals, and in the Harvard case, they're claiming that Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants, citing higher average test scores and GPAs as the, you know, that Asian Americans have these higher quantitative numbers and then they should be admitted at higher rates than they already are. And in fact, Asian Americans are admitted at very high rates in actuality. When you look at the data, Asian Americans have the highest rates of admission at Harvard. That admission rate is very low because it's Harvard. So we're talking about, you know, 5% admission rate. With over 40,000 people applying every year. And so that's the claim. What's interesting in the lawsuit is that in court this past fall, not one Asian American testified to corroborate that claim. Instead, several Asian American students testified in defense of Harvard's race-conscious admissions practices because, and this is in alignment with a lot of data demonstrating that Asian Americans support affirmative action. They see the benefits. They see that they are directly beneficiaries of affirmative action.
I wonder how you think this case illustrates. I think there are a lot of stereotypes around Asian Americans. And one of them is that it's sort of a monolith that we are all kind of the same people, which I think is a little ironic. So you and I are in the same category. Mm-hmm. You have a Chinese heritage. My family has an Indian heritage by way of the Caribbean, but we're still in the same group.
Right.
Right.
Same demographic.
Right. Yep. So I wonder how much you think this case illustrates maybe that there are there are different ways that people look at this issue, whether they're Asian American or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that in some of my research I've been finding, and what I'll talk about a little bit on campus today, is the divisions within the very diverse Asian American community. What we've been finding in the last several years is that Chinese Americans, even though on the whole Asian Americans across the board, the majority support affirmative action, Chinese American support has actually declined significantly since 2012 for various reasons that I've written about in my research.
What are some of them?
Things like, for Chinese Americans, I think the immigration flows in the population has changed, especially since 1990. So my family came here in the 1960s. And a lot of the Chinese Americans who are actively opposing affirmative action today, they arrived here after 1990. They came here with a little bit more social and economic capital. So a lot of them came over as graduate students because of the shifts in immigration policy that privileged folks with professional and educational capital. So they're a different class, I think. There's less class diversity amongst post-90 immigrants. Also, but at the same time, these immigrants remain, like many immigrants, I think, culturally isolated. And so where they get their news, how they talk about politics is different than the mainstream population. For some of these more recent Chinese immigrants, they are using something called WeChat. Something I learned through my research. I'd never heard of WeChat before until 2016.
I was going to say, it's very popular. It's Urbana.
Okay, yeah. Well, large international population mm-hmm. here in Urbana. And so it's a very popular social media app, and it's become what some communications researchers have called a complete echo chamber of Chinese diaspora. And so you get a proliferation of false information, misinformation that really stokes the fear that I think a lot of Chinese immigrants have, a real fear, quite frankly, of discrimination and racism, as we see demonstrated in the Duke case. And so it's this just coming together of a lot of information and misinformation that then brings about this outrage that is both emotionally charged, and there's some fact and a lot of misinformation mm-hmm. in there that's doing this. Yeah.
My guest is Oyen Poon. She's a former Loyola Chicago professor. She's now currently at Colorado State University, where she's she's an assistant professor and the director of its RISE Center. That's a Center for Race and Intersectional Studies for Educational Equity. She's giving a lecture at the Illini Union at the University of Illinois this afternoon. We're getting a little bit of a preview here. Oyen, can I ask you just about the whole issue of affirmative action? As you were just talking about the misconceptions, the misinformation, whether it's among the Chinese American community or others, I think there's not a great understanding mm-hmm. of what affirmative action means when it comes to college campuses. And this is obviously an issue that you deal very closely with.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned in higher education, so affirmative action operates, there's three general categories, one around college admissions, one around employment, and one around public contracting. My work really focuses a lot on the admissions piece. And I think there's a lot of misinformation, as I mentioned, about how it works in admissions. There's a lot of assumptions that it's a racial quota that was deemed unconstitutional in the Bakke case in 1978.
So that doesn't happen.
It's not supposed to happen. If it does, it's illegal and should stop. Essentially with a quota that would be a set aside for certain numbers of students of various demographics. The other misconception oftentimes is that there is a racial preference or a point bonus for underrepresented minority applicants. But that is also illegal, as deemed by a 2003 Supreme Court case against the University of Michigan. That was the Gratz v. Bollinger case. That was the undergraduate admissions case. On the flip side, both the 78 case in Bakke and 2003 case against the University of Michigan Law School, the Grutter case, they have affirmed and reaffirmed that diversity is a very important thing for creating the best possible educational environments for teaching and learning. And that was again reaffirmed in 2016 in the Fisher case by the Supreme Court. So you can take race as one of many, many factors in the process of reviewing and selecting students for college admission. But the way it's done in 2019, post-Fisher 2016, is that it's done through a holistic process where each individual applicant is treated as an individual and seen within their context of opportunity, so that schools, admissions committees can see a student coming from an under-resourced high school who is doing the best possible they can. They've taken all the most rigorous coursework and done very well versus a student who goes to a very well-resourced high school. And these stratification by where people go to high school is very raced and classed. And so affirmative action today allows admissions committees to look at each of these individual students within their context of opportunity, who they are, their family environments, their school environments, et cetera.
So you said something to me before we were on air that mm-hmm. it's not just about a test score.
Right.
And that it's really, we have to think about this as looking at the whole person.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, the ACT and the SAT, the people who sell those tests, they even acknowledge that their tests are not good measures of whether or not someone has academic chops.
And so I wonder how you think about, when I'm thinking in particular about the Harvard case, but then sort of this broader issue of affirmative action, especially how it relates to Asians and Asian Americans. I wonder how you think that reflects, if that's a sort of a microcosm of the way when we think about Asian American race relations in this country or how people relate to Asian Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Ed Bloom and SFFA have done something kind of diabolical. In that understanding, this nation doesn't have a very good grasp on race relations, and they definitely don't have a very good grasp on Asian Americans and where we fit. And they're counting on people to work within the stereotype of Asian Americans, you and I, being all the same, that we're all academically ridiculous overachievers. But when you look at Asian Americans and, quite frankly, all populations, there's a lot of diversity within that, you know, these categories of population. And so affirmative action, the way it's practiced today, we need to look at the whole person. We need to look at where they're coming from to understand their potential for achievement and their past achievements.
And when to circle us back to the beginning of our conversation, when we think about last week, the Duke University case, how we're seeing activism around this issue, how do you think that has changed the way, not just the Asian American community, but I even think how social media has changed the way that we look at this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I remember very few cases where there's been this kind of outrage. I would like to see
where
more
people mobilize.
Yeah, where people really mobilize and the university just jumped at the opportunity to do something right away. I mean, within 24 hours, Dr. Neely had already been, you know, had resigned from her post. You know, I think that as universities like Duke and the University of Illinois have such large populations of international students, quite frankly, it's a matter of revenue. Oftentimes, it's not just about global diversity in this case. You know, when you're bringing in international students, they are also bringing international monies that the state, when the state has divested from public higher education, you need to find other resources of revenue. And unfortunately, international students are quite often seen as that source of revenue.
Which is a whole other conversation that we do not have time for today. But I want to thank you for coming by. Oyun Poon is an assistant professor and director of Colorado State University's RISE Center, a guest here at the University of Illinois. She's going to be delivering a lecture at noon if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area at the Illini Union. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla. It's great to be here.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a new play that opens this evening that's actually the year celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. That was 50 years ago this summer. The play is called Hit the Wall. I'll be speaking with the director and a dramaturg coming up. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've probably heard of Stonewall Inn, the 6 days of rioting and disturbances there in the summer of 1969 in and around Stonewall are commonly thought of as the beginning of the LGBT civil rights movement. President Obama actually designated the area in New York's Greenwich Village as the first ever monument to the LGBT movement. But how much do we actually know about what happened? Well, those events have been dramatized in a play that opens this evening and runs through February 10th at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Robert Gerard Anderson is the director of the play Hit the Wall. He's also an associate professor at the University of Illinois Department of Theater. Madeline Whitesell is the play's dramaturg and a master's student in the same department, and both of them are with me in our studios in Urbana. Anderson, Madeline, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Great to be
Thank
here.
Thank you for having us.
Madeline, I want to start with you and just ask, what did you know about the history of this before you got involved in this play?
That's a good question. I knew very general ideas about the Stonewall Inn. I've been to New York before, so I'd been outside of it, and I'd seen it as a monument. I knew that it was a riot. I knew that it was some sort of catalyst for the LGBT rights movement. And I knew that it was part of the reason that Pride parades happened, but outside of that, I didn't know much about it. And I think that a lot of the other students in the show share the same sentiments as me. It's not really something we're taught in schools. It's more kind of this mythology that we hear of and more of a story that we hear of than any sort of actual historical facts that we learn about.
Right. And Anderson, I learned a lot from the play because I think lots of people have sort of a vague notion of Stonewall riots, LGBT civil rights. Why did you want to bring this play to the university?
Well, for lots of reasons. I love the playwright, Ike Holter. He's really a great emerging young playwright from Chicago. This is one of his first plays, but he writes a lot about race and gender and class and gentrification. And I love his work because it's funny and it's witty and it's incredibly potent politically, but it's also not preachy. I feel like there's a real sort of entertainment to it, and he's interested in the history and, like, who gets to own that history. So the playwright was a big reason. I also think that American universities are some of the most sort of homophobic and sort of transphobic and heteronormative places in the country. Even though we're very liberal, that stuff is still embedded. So I feel like we want to present plays here, and the students are usually so far ahead of us, including in terms of their understanding and their interest in these sorts of things. So I thought it would be a good play for us to do, for the students to explore the history, but also get their passion behind, because they have a lot of passion for these ideas. Our department also, one of our mission statements is we stand for radical inclusion. So we want to look at stories that are about people who have been on the margins, people who haven't been invited into the center, and playwrights who haven't been invited into the center of these conversations in terms of cultural conversations. I'm a gay man, too. I was brought up during this period. I was more affected by the AIDS crisis, but I think there are a lot of connections between this movement and then what happened later with Stonewall and then the AIDS crisis. So I find a real connection between, like, a personal connection between those things. So lots of reasons to do it. And it's just a damn good play.
Mm-hmm. When we think about what happened over that 6-day period, most everyone generally agrees on sort of the broad generalities of what happened, right? There was this club, Stonewall Inn. It was mostly frequented by gay men, although there were a few lesbians and transgender people who were also there. And at the heart of the play, there's this horrific confrontation, actually, not between the police and between gay men, but between a lesbian and transgender woman. I wonder if you guys could speak to why you think they're also the focus of this, as you're talking about different people left on the margins of this.
I mean, I think the play works to include everybody, which I think is a great thing that the playwright does. I mean, I think he wants to place people of color at the center of the story because they were at the center of the story. And they have even been slightly, I think, rewritten by white gay activists.
You mean written out of the story?
Yeah, I think they have been. I think people do say, you know, black drag queens started this. But then it became really a movement that was supported primarily by white gay men. The movement then was sort of taken over in some way. And I don't know if it was completely rewritten, but the power was with white gay men after that. So I think that the playwright wanted to, and we certainly wanted to represent that as much as we could with our pool, the centrality of those people, of people of color, and also conversations that still exist in the LGBT community about race and class, and that those separations that are still there and potent. And then we have two trans actors who are in the show. And I think that adds some interesting sort of, I mean, they're amazing. And they were cast because they were the right people for the parts. But there's something about their presence. And I don't know if they would exist in the period that the play was set precisely as they do now. So we had to have some sort of deep conversations about how we are going to, the casting, the representation, their willingness to represent these characters and their sexual preference and all sorts of issues around who they were in the play.
Yeah, I think that another thing to add is that police brutality, especially towards transgender women of color, is much more prevalent. And I think that this play does a good job of representing that accurately and in the way that the police interact with the different characters and how they leave some alone and are much more brutal to other characters. And I think that has a lot to do with their race and their gender representation.
It's a pretty big cast.
Yep.
So
yeah.
We've been talking about two of the characters that are central to a lot of the action towards the end of the play. Whose eyes do we see this through? There's a lot of different characters here.
This is Ike's work, too, the playwright. There's sort of a Greek chorus of these two snap queens, which is a term used for certain kinds of gay men of that period and beyond. You might think of sort of like the kind of conversations that happen on RuPaul's drag show. It's that sort of persona. And they're played by a young African-American actor and a young Latinx actor. We don't necessarily see it through their eyes, but they kind of lead us through in some way, like a Greek chorus through the play. So sometimes they're doing direct address to the audience. Sometimes they're interacting with other characters. Sometimes they're just sort of like throwing shade on the side of the play.
Yeah, and they're sort of like the color commentators throughout the entire play.
You know, whatever,
play.
The Muppet Show or something. Yeah. I mean, it's really a brilliant conceit, but it also gives us the freedom to be able to have that commentary. So I think they're an important part of the kind of like the chorus of it. Yeah.
And Anderson, I know you've produced a lot of Shakespeare, and I was thinking, I was wondering about that because the cadence of, yes. I was thinking of it, it's almost like a spoken word rap mm-hmm. battle, rapid fire speech. And I wonder how your background in Shakespeare was helpful for these folks in that cadence.
Well, it's so helpful. I mean, I think I was attracted to the play originally and all of his work because of the language. Just the wit and how quick it is and how a serious moment is embedded into all this humor and how people use language as a weapon and as a way to disclose things and as a way to fight and as a way to love and as a way to obfuscate what's happening. I just think the language is so brilliant and so fun and entertaining, but also can be brutal. And that is Shakespeare. It's that same Shakespeare training. So to have our students, some of who are new grad students working on this, along with Shakespeare, a lot of those skills and that training is shared.
Yeah, I think also for these characters, humor is often used as this protective armor, especially these characters on the street. It's what they use to cover up more hurt and anger.
I wonder if you all can also explain a little bit about the casting of this. You were talking about some of the different people who tried out play, this production of Hit the Wall. We're talking about the opening Thursday, hopefully tonight, at Cranert Center for the Performing Arts, and it's on through February 10th. There's a deaf actor in this play. And then you also have screens throughout the entire studio theater, so the entire play is subtitled.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know if that was the way the play was written or if that was something that you all changed with this production.
It was not the way the play was written. As I said, we have this commitment to inclusion and radical inclusion in our department. And so what that means in this case is that when we do our recruiting, we're looking at the best actors that we can bring here, no matter what their ability, how they identify, and also looking at people who aren't normally included in a pool of actors at an MFA. So with Andrew Merrill, who's an actor who happens to be deaf, he was the best actor that I saw in New York City at the URTAs, which are these big group auditions for resident university theater programs. So when I saw him, I envisioned, like, how are we going to do this? You know, and so he's been a great advocate for the deaf community here and elsewhere. So, you know, the deaf community in this area and in this region needs to know that whenever we do a play now with Andrew, we're going to try to have this closed captioning, which means they don't have to choose the night that they see the show, especially in a language show like this, to really get the language and the nuance of the language. So we were looking at casting him as this character, sort of a drifter that comes in, and he's a wonderful actor. In every community, there's certainly a presence of deaf people and signing the ASL world. But in the gay community, there is a real presence of gay deaf people. So I thought, you know, it could work. And then the actor who's playing sort of his love interest in the play learned ASL.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, he learned the entire role in ASL. And the backstory that we just added, without really changing, I think, any of the text, that's his home language, that, like, he is a deaf family or he came from a deaf community, you know, background. And so he knew it. So that's one of the reasons that they initially connected. Hopefully it sort of disappears as a special thing and we just get into their story, which is what we hope happens and what I think happens.
Well, and in fact, it's an interesting layer that I think is actually a really powerful element in the play, because when they're communicating, it's silent. And yeah. Much of the film, there's a live band that's sort of a soundtrack in the corner. As you said, there is this Greek chorus. There's a lot of stuff going on. So
layered,
it actually creates such a different moment because of the silence and the way they're communicating.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. He's such a wonderful actor, and that's the number one thing about him, what he's contributing to the department and to the university, actually.
Going back to sort of our initial conversation about the different people and the different perspectives that are represented here, I couldn't help but just think of a parallel of how we've been talking about the Women's March and the second anniversary and how it, different groups have fragmented into feeling like they need to have their own march to represent their interests. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as you think about the role of a dramaturg and adapting this, how you thought about that whole issue of intersectionality when it comes to this play and how it relates to today.
One of the lines from one of the characters, Roberta, is, "I went to the Black Panthers and they didn't want to listen to me." I won't say the actual line, but it's because she was gay. And then she says, "I go to the women's movement, and they said that our movement was too fragile right now for women of color, so I had to start my own movement." And I think that part of the reason the LGBTQ movement was formed was because they were rejected from other movements. This riot, Stonewall, brought together a lot of different groups of people that became fragmented throughout the movement, but this one event included a lot of different groups of people.
It really forced the hand, I think, of a lot of people that we have to come together for this. It's just the beginning of us coming together as a powerful source for each other. But then it did happen again during the AIDS crisis where, you know, lesbians were nursing gay men and helping them through the crisis. And we came together again as a group to try to solve things. But I feel like we do, we continue to come together and come apart.
And as we think of this, I can't help but just think of the news, terrible incident in Chicago with the Empire actor. I don't know if you guys have...
I just saw that briefly, yeah.
Yeah, just been looking at the online conversation today about he's a gay Black man, so was this a racist attack? Was this a homophobic attack?
Sure.
It can be both.
Right.
And that's not necessarily always part of our conversation when we're thinking about these things.
Absolutely. I think that the idea of race and gender and all these things are still so troubling, and we're still trying to dissect them. And I think the play is a great format for us to be able to like sit and think about the contradictions that are still embedded into our discussion about all of these things.
Yeah, you can really see through the different interactions of the characters all of these intersections between race and gender within the gay community that a lot of times people from the outside would not know even exist, that these issues exist. Especially you can see the white privilege of someone like the character A-Gay versus some of the other queer characters of color, and that privilege that he has both with the cop and sexually and just living his life. And also the idea of being able to pass as straight gives him a certain amount of privilege that it doesn't give other people. So
we're still struggling, I think, as gay people and members of the LGBT community, as be like we're different. There's many different kinds of us. I've had to said so many times on this campus, I'm not that kind of gay, the one that they want me to be, the mouth that they want me to have, even the concerns that they want me to represent. And I think this play, especially the first half of the play, which is quite entertaining, actually points at that there's lots of conflict, there's lots of judgment, there's lots of different ways of presenting and representing and sharing your sexuality or not that is in our community, that it is a diverse community and not particularly functional sometimes, you know, and not together in some ways. And I think that's part of the thing the playwright was really interested in looking at, which is, I think, informative for people to experience, I think.
The play is Hit the Wall. Robert Gerard Anderson is the director. Madeline Whitesell is the dramaturg. It is on through February 10th in Champaign-Urbana at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Anderson, Madeline, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, pets have gotten just as obese as many of their human owners. What can we do to keep our pets healthy? And what can we learn about our own health from our pets? Stay tuned. We'll be talking about that right after the break. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Temperatures are warming. It was just above zero when I pulled into the station parking lot in Urbana this morning. It's six now. It's kind of crazy to think of those temperatures as warmer. I do hope you are staying warm and safe in this weather. Weather Channel meteorologist Greg Diamond just tweeted that actually, per the National Weather Service's Quad Cities reporting, 38 degrees below zero was reported in Mount Carroll, Illinois, this morning. And he said that if that's accurate, it would set a new Illinois state record for low temperatures. With this bitter cold, it can be difficult. Yesterday, it was dangerous to get up and go out of the house. And for many of us, that also means our pets are also stuck inside. And just like humans, pets are vulnerable to weight gain if they don't get the right exercise. Sometimes it's tempting to feed our pets those extra table scraps. And while it can be cute to see pets put on a few extra pounds, obesity comes with just as serious side of health effects for pets as it does for humans. What you might not realize is that when your pet is unhealthy, that can also indicate health consequences for people. Scientists have been studying those links. Joining us now to talk about this is Dr. Jack Herman. He is a clinical associate professor at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. He's also affiliated with UIC's School of Public Health. On the line with us now from Chicago. Dr. Herman, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for asking me.
So we hear about the obesity epidemic among humans all the time. Are we seeing similar things in the pet world, Dr. Herman?
Yes, we are. The prevalence of overweight and obesity mirrors that in the human population. Roughly a third of pets, and when we're talking about pets, we're talking the larger group of companion animals, so dogs and cats and smaller animals in addition to horses. We're seeing the same prevalences of overweight about a third and obese about a third.
And what are some of the reasons why we're seeing this? Is it the same as reasons we're seeing for humans?
Sure. You know, we have a lot of social determinants of overweight and obesity. It's not as simple as just too many calories in and too many calories out. There's community environment, there's behaviors, there's genetics and epigenetics, comorbidities, other diseases that the animal may have. And then there's also a lot of environmental toxicant exposure, endocrine disrupting chemicals that affect companion animals as well as people.
And so when we say there's environmental toxins that affect animals' endocrine system, what does that mean and how do we see that play out?
Well, one of the most research examples is the condition of hyperthyroidism in cats associated with bisphenol A, BPA, BPS, in canned cat food liners. So the liner inside the cat food, that which is sprayed on to keep the cat food stable. And that's been shown, chronic exposure has been shown with disrupting thyroid function. And we see the same thing in people as well. There's a lot of endocrine disrupting chemicals. In fact, we're exposed to them every day. We're basically bathed in them. And they can affect fat metabolism and the function of insulin and leptin and ghrelin and thyroid and even reproductive hormones.
And so, Dr. Herman, as we're thinking about how this is displayed in pets, I wonder how much we're learning about how this affects humans as well as we're seeing animals having the same consequences that some humans are having.
Yeah, the research goes both ways. It's an example to some degree of what we call one health problem, a problem that approaches human health, animal health, and ecosystem health as interrelated and inextricably linked. And so when we look at overweight and obesity, the risk factors for companion animals and for humans are so similar. And so if we want to modify some of those or decrease some of those risks, we can approach them in basically the same way.
And before we get to how we could do that, can I ask, are we seeing these same effects in animals that are not pets? Are we seeing these things happen in wild animals?
Yeah, not so much. I guess if we broadly describe our animal population as companion animals, production animals, so food production animals, cattle and sheep and goats for the most part, and pigs, and then wildlife, we just don't see it in wildlife. You know, they're either predators or prey, and they're constantly moving and either trying to eat or trying to keep from being eaten. And on the production animal side, our production animal's nutrition is so finely tuned that we very seldom see what we would call the metabolic syndrome in people and in animals just from lousy diets or improperly balanced diets because they are production animals. I'm thinking primarily of dairy cattle, for example. A standard dairy farm will have probably up to 6 different rations going, and so the nutrition is so well monitored and delivered that we very seldom see that in production animals. It's usually companion animals.
Interesting. And when we say metabolic syndrome problems, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, metabolic syndrome is there's 4 cardinal or basic components of it, and that's heart disease, hypertension, dyslipidemias, or you know, goofed up cholesterol and triglyceride and high density and low density lipoprotein levels, as well as type 2 diabetes, so high blood sugar level. And then there's 4 other components that are increased in risk. So there's an increase in risk for various forms of cancer. There's an increase of risk for early cognitive decline or dementia in people. It's hard to pick up on that in dogs and cats so much. And then also polycystic ovarian syndrome in both animals and in people, and of course non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome that we actually do see in dogs, cats, and people. So there's those 4 cardinal components, and then there's 4 increased risk factors that are associated with the metabolic syndrome.
My guest is Dr. Jack Herman. We're talking to him about both pets and humans and obesity. And Dr. Herman, when we're thinking about, you were talking, it struck me when you were talking, for example, about factory animals, factory farm factory animals, they're thinking about cows. You said their nutrition is so finely tuned, they don't have these problems. Is part of the problem when we're thinking about just, first of all, obesity with human pets, you talked about some of the environmental factors, but is it also just about the amount of food that we're giving animals?
Yeah. Our portion sizes have certainly increased, and we have that same tendency to kill our pets with kindness. You know, pets will come in all sorts of different body types. The dog family, the dog genus is a great example. You know, you could have everything from a Great Dane all the way down to a Chihuahua. And very similarly, people come in all different shapes and sizes too. And so, you know, if you applied the body condition score on a English bulldog to a hunting dog, that would not be good. Hunting dogs are a different body type completely. They're leaner and more athletic. Similarly, with people, you know, an offensive lineman has a different body type from a wide receiver, a defensive back, or a weightlifter has a different body type from a marathoner. And it doesn't mean that one is more fit than the other. It's just that there's different body types. And where we can get into trouble is that we think the roly-poly little English bulldog who looks so cute because he's so chubby and that's his body type, and maybe he's metabolically healthy. We can't make a golden retriever, for example, look like that and expect it to be healthy. They'll break down both metabolically and physically. So a lot of it is image, what we think an animal should look like, and we have to recognize what they should look like.
And as a veterinarian, I wonder how you would advise pet owners to be aware of body types with their pets in terms of making sure they're... It's hard enough, I feel like, for people to figure that out. So how can we figure that out for our pets?
Yeah, a lot of it can go back to actually just increasing your knowledge base on what kind of dog or cat you're getting. And again, you know, there's so much more variation in dogs than in cat body types that I'll refer to dogs. So do a little research about what they're supposed to look like, but also consult with your veterinarian. We in veterinary medicine have been concerned about overweight and obesity for at least 30, 40 years. I started in practice in 1978, and we've had these discussions going on for what now, 40, 41 years. And so your veterinarian is going to have a really good take on how to recognize when a dog is getting overweight and what steps you can take to mitigate that weight gain and maybe even decrease the weight.
And Dr. Herman, what do we know about if humans are trying to eat healthier, what kind of effect that has on their pets or vice versa? Do we know if there's a link for that?
Anecdotally, just from being in practice, it seemed like the households who ate healthy had pretty much healthy weight pets. Where we can get into trouble is that we very often, and we've seen this again for decades, we will apply the same sort of dietary fads that we see in the human population to our pets. And so just in the last two or three years, we've been seeing a lot of gluten-free dog and cat foods come out. And in consulting with colleagues who are internal medicine specialists, especially in gastrointestinal diseases, they will say flat out there is absolutely no evidence of celiac disease or gluten hypersensitivity in dogs or cats. So there's absolutely no reason to feed a gluten-free diet to a dog or cat. And, you know, it brings to mind, too, back in the 80s where there was a craze about fat, about saturated fat. Now, you know, you have to have a certain amount of saturated fat in your diet to be metabolically healthy. You can't overdo it. What happened in the 80s is we swung the other way. We knocked the fat down, and everything was fat-free but really loaded with sugar. And so you have to watch that, too. You have to recognize, you know, just basic good human nutrition. The principles of good basic human nutrition will apply to good basic animal nutrition as well.
And I wonder how my understanding of all of this, as we're thinking about animal nutrition and treating the problems in animals, how this can lead to better human nutrition as well.
Can you rephrase that a bit?
Well, I'm just wondering if you think how this could lead to better lifestyles for people as we're thinking about how we treat our animals as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is recognition not only of basic nutrition, but also portion sizes and also the importance of exercise. We have a number of programs that we have conducted at University of Illinois and also in private practice where we encourage people to use pedometers and get out and walk. And it's a little bit difficult when it's really cold out or if you live in an environment that it's not conducive to walking. But just walking will not only improve your pet's health, but also improve your own.
That's Dr. Jack Herman, a clinical associate professor. As you're hearing, he teaches in the College of Vet Med at the University of Illinois. He's also affiliated with UIC's School of Public Health. Dr. Herman, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for asking, and it's been my pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today and for this week. Coming up on Monday, are you ready to file your taxes? The deadline's April 15th, but it's never too early to start, especially with the new tax law going into effect.
Because our tax laws so frequently change as the political climate changes, maintaining records in order to get the best overall tax deduction is smart. Even if you can't use it, it's easier to throw it out after the fact than it is to try to slap your head with the forehead with your hand and say, oh my gosh, I wished I'd have known that.
That's tax advisor Carmi Gregory. She's based in Sycamore in DeKalb County. She and other tax experts join us on Monday's program. Of course, there's been a lot of talk about how the government shutdown affected the IRS. As you probably know, talk of that shutdown has been averted, at least for a few weeks, until February 15th. That's the deadline for Congress and the president to come up with another government funding plan. All that week, we are going to be broadcasting live from our nation's capital. We'll be taking the 21st to NPR headquarters in D.C. We'll be speaking with lawmakers, Illinoisans who've moved to Washington, even longtime NPR hosts and native Chicagoan Scott Simon. This year, we've introduced a new way for you to interact with us. It's called Ask the 21st. It's a place for you to ask questions you'd like us to research. And now, we're curious what questions you have about Washington. Leave us a question by going to askthe21st.org. We'll try to answer it maybe even ahead of our trip or while we're in D.C. Again, that website is askthe21st.org. That does it for us this week. There's lots of ways to connect with us and listen to past shows. You can use the NPR One app. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background. Thanks for all your tweets about the cold weather. If you go to our account, by the way, you'll see a video of a listener and Forsyth sent us of boiling water in freezing weather. I don't know if anyone tried that yesterday. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a great place to find all the information on how to contact us as well. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here on Monday.